right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a packed show for you today. I'm really glad to be here, but really anxious to get into the show, so let's not hesitate any longer. At the back end of the show, we're going to be hearing from Sansara Taylor, speaking about the attempts to basically turn people against a really important new film called Birth of a Nation. Before that, we're going to be talking with Richard Grant about a place called the Dismal Swamp, which is a newly discovered chapter in the history of slavery in America. And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to be talking with Elisa Hartz, attorney with Public Counsel. A couple weeks ago, I was reading the Sunday LA Times, and I came across an editorial by Lawrence Tribe. And the editorial was about a lawsuit that was going on in the state of Michigan, and in Detroit in particular. And it was a lawsuit that was challenging the conditions of the schools that are schools for children of color. I was just really eager to find out what was going on with this. And actually, one of the groups that's part of the lawsuit, a big part of the lawsuit, is a group called Public Counsel. And we got through to Public Counsel, and I'm very pleased to welcome today to the show Elisa Hartz, who's an attorney with Public Counsel. Elisa, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Sure. Very happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this. It's when I read about this, it was kind of one of those things that just sort of slaps you in the head and makes you dizzy after a while. It's kind of, what the hell is going on here?
Yes, it's astonishing what's happening in the schools in Detroit.
Well, you're one of the attorneys working on this lawsuit, and it's a suit against Governor Snyder and other state officials in the state of Michigan, and it's around, as we were saying, public education in the city of Detroit in particular. Let's give people an overview. Why the lawsuit, and what's it about?
So this lawsuit is asserting the right to literacy under the federal Constitution. And the lawsuit alleges that the state of Michigan is depriving certain Detroit students of their fundamental right to literacy. So that's the basic premise of the lawsuit. We investigated the schools in Detroit because the proficiency scores are extremely low, and Detroit ranks extremely low in terms of both the state and the nation. So it seemed like a really important place to bring the first case asserting the federal right to literacy.
Now, something I read said that this case was based on the 14th Amendment. For people that don't know, the 14th Amendment was one of those amendments that, in the aftermath of the Civil War, it was one of the Reconstruction Amendments. And it did a lot. It addressed citizenship rights and equal protection laws, and was proposed in response to issues related to former slaves, in particular following the Civil War. Why the 14th Amendment?
The 14th Amendment guarantees the right to equal protection of the law, and it also protects fundamental rights of Americans. And our argument is that the 14th Amendment is really important in guaranteeing the right to literacy, both because the Constitution establishes a fundamental right to literacy and because the Constitution requires that all children have equal access to literacy. So the kids in Detroit should have the same access to literacy as the kids in Grosse Pointe.
That isn't true, though, right? They don't have the same access to literacy or anything else in the schools, whether it's Ann Arbor, Grosse Pointe, or whatever. They don't have the same kind of situation in those schools as they do in Detroit.
That's correct. And the point of the lawsuit is to say that that violates the Constitution. So all children have the right to equal access to literacy. But in the schools in Detroit, the students are being deprived of the same access to that right that students in other more wealthy schools have. And it's no coincidence that the schools where students do have the access to literacy are predominantly white, and the schools in Detroit are almost entirely students of color.
Now, there's been other lawsuits over the right to read, for instance, brought by the ACLU in 2012, and it was a decision saying the state is only required to provide for and finance public schools. They really don't have to do the education. They just have to have those schools available. How is this lawsuit different?
This lawsuit is different because the lawsuit you're referring to, the ACLU suit, was brought under the state constitution. This lawsuit is brought under the federal constitution, so we're saying that the federal constitution is more protective than the state constitution. Our lawsuit could modify what the state of Michigan is required to do, but it's also establishing a right that would hold true for everybody across the country. And unfortunately, Detroit schools are some of the worst in the country, but they are not alone in depriving students of access to literacy.
What exactly is the state of literacy or proficiency rates among Detroit public school students?
The District of Detroit is one of the lowest performing districts in the state of Michigan. Michigan itself is ranked last in the country in literacy and math for fourth grade African American students. And in fourth grade reading and math, about 91% of African American students are below proficiency in Michigan. In Detroit, the public students ranked last in reading and math proficiency among all big city school districts in the country. And the schools that our lawsuit is addressing are the lowest performing schools in the city of Detroit. So the schools are ranked in the first, second, and fourth and sixth percentile in Michigan schools, so very, very low performing schools. And this means that the proficiency levels are in the single digit, so it's really dire. A very, very tiny percentage of students in our plaintiff schools are proficient in reading and math.
So is the lawsuit only concerned about that chunk of schools and the position you were just talking about, or is it generally the case in Detroit that the schools suck?
So Detroit is a very low-performing district. Our lawsuit is a class action that is specifically targeting four schools, and the class of students are the students who attend or attended those schools. But our hope is that when we establish this right to literacy, the whole district would then comply with the requirements of the Constitution.
When you say the right to literacy, let's talk about that, because your firm actually has advanced what I thought was a very moving and very unique interpretation of the right to literacy being a human right. That's a concept that not many people think of, the right to literacy, and what it has to do with being a human.
That's correct. The right to literacy is not only important for students who need to learn to read, but it's important for access to any kind of knowledge and communication. And really critically, the right to literacy is so important for participating in our democracy. So in order to participate in a jury or to sign up for selective service or to be an informed citizen in our democracy, you need to have the right to literacy. The power of the right to literacy, I think, can be seen in the fact that it was a crime originally for slaves to be taught how to read. So even the people who were depriving slaves of the right to literacy were recognizing its power and realizing that with this ability to read and comprehend and exchange information comes a lot of social power that allows participation in democracy.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Elisa Hart, an attorney with Public Counsel, and we're talking about a class action suit they filed against the state of Michigan for denying students in the schools in Detroit their constitutional right to literacy. When you talk about the tie-in with how slaves were treated and what it meant for a slave to be able to read, to be able to write, to be able to communicate with people in that kind of form, it was a very heavy thing. And people, I mean, there was all kinds of stories, all kinds of slave stories about people who tried to teach other slaves how to read and how they were just horribly, horribly tortured in front of all the other slaves simply for teaching people how to read. The fact that you were calling this a human right, it really struck me. It really went right back to that situation. And including your basis for the lawsuit on the 14th Amendment, which also was involved very much with what are the rights of ex-slaves after the Civil War? What were their rights and how much were they actually welcomed into the community of humanity by this system?
It's incredibly important, and it's also the foundation of the Supreme Court's decision in Brown v. Board of Education, the case that established that you could not provide segregated education that was separate but not equal. The requirement of allowing African-American children to become full citizens in the country is really mediated through education, and literacy is the fundamental building block of education. And I think the legacy of depriving slaves of access to literacy has kind of passed through history in its reverse form with respect to the value that African-American families place on education and on ensuring that their children are able to have this power and to speak for themselves and have full participation in our democracy.
One of the things I wanted to ask you, too, is that the school system there didn't just say, okay, to hell with these people. We're not going to teach them anything. We're just going to throw them in the garbage can and let them rot. But essentially, that's what happened. I mean, when I read the description of the conditions in the school, it just whacked me in the head very hard. And I wanted you to tell people, what are the conditions in the school like? Give people a sense of what we're talking about here.
First of all, I just want to say that this is a lawsuit against the state, not against the Detroit district, and not against the particular schools, and certainly not against the teachers at the schools. The schools and the teachers and people in the schools care deeply about education, care deeply about the students, and they simply do not have the resources in order to provide what they need to be able to provide to their students. So with that caveat, the conditions in these schools are absolutely not conducive to any kind of teaching and learning. The building conditions are dangerous and decrepit. The water is often unsafe to drink. There are leaks in the ceilings. There are extreme temperatures in the classrooms. At the beginning of the school year, students actually passed out. Schools had to close because they were so hot. And then in the winter, students and teachers have to bundle up, wear coats. They can see their breath while they're in the classroom. So these material conditions, you can imagine, make it impossible to concentrate and for teachers to do their job. At the same time, the teachers do not have the resources that they need in order to teach these courses successfully. If they have books, they do not have enough books, so you have for students sharing books. There are some students who have never had a book to take home for homework, and as a result, teachers don't even assign homework because there's no way to give the assignment. The teachers, because they don't have books, will make photocopies of materials for the students to use, but there isn't even enough paper or toner in the printers, and so teachers end up spending up to $1,000 of their own money in providing these materials for their students.
It's amazing to me. I read where some of the schools were even infested with vermin, with rats and all kinds of things that were going all over the school. How is that a school?
Yes, exactly. We have one student who told us that he won't put his backpack on the ground because the cockroaches climb into it. I mean, imagine going to a school like that for your education. It just makes these kids feel like their education isn't valued.
I read something where one teacher said every morning before he opens the door to his classroom, he has to clean the rat droppings out.
Yeah, those material conditions are, on the one hand, they don't have enough materials. On the other hand, they're simply unsanitary and very distracting, and teachers end up spending a lot of time trying to make the room presentable for their students. And in addition, there's a massive teacher shortage. As you can imagine, these positions for teachers are not very desirable because the conditions are so challenging when you have to put in your own money or sign up on donors choose to get the resources that you need for your students, it doesn't make you run and try to get a job at these schools. So there's a teacher shortage, and as a result, students end up being taught by people who are not certificated teachers. In one case, there was an eighth grader who was teaching his math class, a seventh and eighth grade math class, for a month because the math teacher had left the school. So this eighth grade student was teaching the math content, and there was a paraprofessional in the room to help with discipline issues. But an eighth grader teaching 7th and 8th grade students math is just not acceptable, and it would never be tolerated in Ann Arbor or Grosse Pointe.
Let's talk a little bit about the on-the-ground impact on the students.
Well, it impacts the students both in terms of what they're actually learning. So you have students who really can't read or write at grade level and are not able to gain the advanced knowledge that they need. So it's not only that students struggle to read, it's that when you struggle to read, you can't read history, right? You can't learn your historical content. You can't read your science textbook if you don't have the appropriate grade level of reading. And teachers can't assign texts that are at the mental level of students if the student's reading level doesn't correspond to where they should be and to where they are developmentally. So this really hampers the education that these students are getting. And as a result, if they're lucky enough to graduate, many of them are not in a position to go on to higher education. If they do go on to higher education, they often struggle in those courses and need remedial work, and it has a big toll on the ability of students to get the jobs that they would otherwise be able to get. So it has major material consequences on these students, but I think it also has really serious psychological consequences on these students because they feel like the state doesn't care about them. You know, they may feel a strong sense of nurturing from their teachers and from their immediate community, but when you walk into your school and have to wear your winter coat or see mouse droppings or have books that have President Bill Clinton as the president, and that's where you're learning history, I think it's hard to feel that the society is valuing your education and really investing in it in the way that you would want it to.
How have the students reacted to the idea of this lawsuit?
The students have been really supportive. We have a broad coalition of community groups who have been involved, and the students that we've spoken with are, I think they don't have the systemic understanding of what's happening, but when you start to talk to them about the conditions in the schools, they really have a lot to say, and they really would like to see things change.
Now, you earlier spoke about the difference between the schools in the inner city Detroit and what was going on with them. And I was thinking about going back to the tie-in with the 14th Amendment, which again had to do with how former slaves would live in U.S. society after the Civil War. It seems to me that a lot of this is very much concentrated in the situation that you're in the middle of. Give people a sense of, like, okay, what are the schools like in places like Ann Arbor and Grosse Pointe?
Well, the proficiency levels are incomparable in those schools. You have a much, much higher percentage of students who are above proficient on the state and national tests. You have a much higher percentage of students going on to higher education. And demographically, the number of students of color is much lower. So in terms of the numbers, Grosse Pointe and Ann Arbor are, I mean, it seems like a different planet from the Detroit schools.
How do they look at the situation, too? I mean, it's just sort of, has no one said, wait a minute, guys, look at this. What's going on here? We have schools that are the equivalent of the highest caliber schools in the country. And yet in Detroit, these kids are barely able to stay alive in these schools.
Yes, I think that's a great question. And there was a recent report on the boundary between Detroit and Grosse Pointe as being the most segregating boundary in the country. So I think this is a question that really needs to be asked. Everybody wants the best education that they can get for their kids. So, of course, parents in Grosse Pointe and parents in Ann Arbor want the same thing for their kids as parents in Detroit. And we think that everybody, all kids, deserve the right to the high-quality education that the kids in Ann Arbor and Grosse Pointe are getting.
Is there anything you'd like to add on as a final comment around this?
We just have been so amazed and impressed and inspired by the community of Detroit students and educators, and we are really honored to be able to help them improve their schools and to hold the state accountable for what it's done to them in terms of the deprivation of the right to literacy.
Going back for a minute to this 14th Amendment and just leading into our final question, the fact that in the previous lawsuits that have been filed against the state of Michigan and its whole practice with the schools, the first lawsuit was overturned or was won by the state. 2 years later, the Michigan Court of Appeals judges ruled against the ACLU again, saying in part that the state constitution only requires that the legislature provide for and finance public schools, leaving the delivery of education services to the local districts. And it really struck me, the tie-in between that and the whole way that right after the Civil War, there was that immediate moment when a lot of the people who had been enslaved really looked at it as like, this is our moment of freedom. 10 years later, it was bam, it's closed down. We don't have any responsibility to anything for people like that. And actually, in some parts of the country, slavery somewhat continued in parts of the South for many, many years. And I kept thinking about this in relation to the 14th Amendment. What do you think about that point of, we don't have to do anything but provide buildings and finance public schools? Let's talk about that in relation to the whole overall 14th Amendment point.
That's exactly what we're arguing against here. These schools that our plaintiffs are in are schools in name only, and it's really an empty promise. And our argument is that the Constitution requires that this promise be fulfilled. And the Supreme Court, in fact, has held, or has acknowledged at least, that an absolute denial of basic education raises serious constitutional issues. And that's what we're really concerned about here, that you can't just formally act as if you are providing an education without that education having some content. And we're saying that the core of that content is literacy. We really feel very strongly that students across the country and in Detroit are entitled to something much more than what the Michigan Court of Appeals held in that case under state law.
All right. Thank you very much, Elisa.
Thank you.
All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Elisa Hartz, attorney with Public Counsel, and we've been talking about a class action lawsuit that they filed against the state of Michigan for denying students in schools in Detroit their constitutional right to literacy. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Matana Roberts with Sons of Slaves. I recently read an article in the Smithsonian Magazine. It just kind of, I had to step back and really think about a whole lot of things that's going on in the world today and things that are being discovered about what happened a long time ago, hundreds of years ago in this country, particularly in this article, the issue of runaway slaves, fugitive slaves, who basically decided that they weren't able to continue to exist under the terrible conditions and what slavery was doing to people, and they split as fast as they could. What everyone always acknowledges is that they went north on the Underground Railroad or they got caught. And I'm going to talk today to Richard Grant, who wrote an article in Smithsonian Magazine basically laying out that there was actually a large, previously unknown population of fugitive slaves and others in one particular one, and we can talk about how far this has actually gone, but in one particular part of the country, which is a place known as the Grand Dismal Swamp, which sits on the Virginia and North Carolina border. Richard, you're a writer for Smithsonian Magazine, and welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah. Your article in the September issue of Smithsonian Magazine told the story of historical archaeologist Dan Sayers and his discovery of a previously unknown history of the Dismal Swamp. And what was that previously unknown history, and what's its significance?
Okay, well, to sum it up baldly, there had been rumors that some escaped slaves had been living in the Great Dismal Swamp before the Civil War. There'd been like odd travelers' accounts and rumors, but there hadn't really been any proof until this archaeologist, Dan Sayers, started working in the middle of the swamp. What he found was that there were three independent communities of escaped slaves living cut up from the rest of the world in the middle of the swamp. They'd formed kind of their own little nation, far, far from humanity, in the middle of a very wild and unforgiving place, but a place where they managed to find freedom and survive for about 10 generations, as far as our best guess goes.
Mm-hmm. From reading your article, I got a sense that the swamp was really key to these escaped slaves and to others that took refuge here.
It's an extremely hostile environment, and this is the only reason that they managed to survive in there. Before the Civil War, the swamp was about 2,000 square miles, and it was too thick to get a horse into. It's covered in thorny briars and muck and thickets. It's got a lot of snakes. There was a lot of bears in there, horrendous mosquitoes in summertime. And it was not a place that anyone wanted to bump around in to try and catch slaves. So that's why they were able to build a free community there, just because it was such a forbidding environment.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty heavy, though, because it wasn't just a place of refuge. They actually did develop these functioning and flowering communities there in a certain sense, which must have been a very difficult thing to do.
Yeah, the archaeologist has found soil footprints of quite large, well-made cabins. He's found some of the tools that they were making. We have a couple of oral history accounts that they were making furniture and musical instruments in the middle of the swamp. And in the early 19th century, there were two kinds of escaped slaves living in the swamp. You had these interior maroons, is the technical term. A maroon is the term for an enslaved person that has managed to emancipate his or herself and find a way of living in freedom. So you had these interior maroon communities on high ground in the middle of the swamp. And then you also, on the edge of the swamp, you had escaped slaves that were kind of doing a bit of day labor, doing a bit of trading. Some of them were committing criminal acts. Others were trading articles with the interior maroon people and then trading those articles out into the outside world. So you had kind of two different ways of living free in the Great Dismal Swamp.
Mm-hmm. Tell me this, what led Sayers to actually do this? Because it's sort of a trip, because you're looking at it and you're thinking, okay, we know about escaped slaves. We know about them making their way out of the South and the Underground Railroad, all this other stuff. And maybe even of some people who hid out in the woods or things like that. But the idea of these flowering communities, before Sayers investigated this, nobody had actually talked about this being possible, right?
Well, there had been talk, but there hadn't been any proof. We've got some travelers' accounts in the 1700s and 1800s, people who saw, you know, a couple of escaped slaves in there and thought there might be more. We had no idea that they were living in well-made cabins, thriving communities. But if you look at it in a global perspective, it's really not that surprising. Everywhere where Africans were enslaved, there were people who got free and formed these free independent communities. You see it all over the Caribbean. You see it all over Latin America. But until Dan Sayers went into the Great Dismal Swamp, it was thought that North America was an exception, that there weren't any of these maroon communities in the U.S. And he's pretty much single-handedly upended that view of our history.
Mm-hmm. What prevented people from actually looking for this there? You say that there were people talking about it, it had been in the wind and stuff like that. But something made Sayers actually decide he was going to do this. And there was no archaeological or historical reason that would point to, hey, you might find something here. But he actually summed some stuff up and decided he had to do this.
He started off by investigating these kind of scant historical records that referred to maroon communities in the swamp. And then he decided there was enough there to go in and start looking for traces, but he didn't know where to look or what to look for. Normally, archaeologists go in with a plan of what they're hoping to find, but he had no idea what he was hoping to find. And he spent a long time getting nowhere. He was looking for high ground. And then eventually one of the guys, it's a national wildlife refuge, one of the refuge biologists knew of some islands in the North Carolina part of the swamp and took him to an island and he just started digging with his shovel and immediately started finding artifacts, and then found out that he couldn't put his shovel in the ground anywhere on this island without turning up evidence of human remains. The earliest stuff is from Native Americans who had used these islands as hunting camps and later as a refuge from the colonial frontier. And then after about 1680, everything he found there suggested that these were escaped slaves or maroons living on this island and living there for generations.
One of the things I read...
So it kind of started out like a wild goose chase, but hit pay dirt in the end.
Yeah, definitely. It's really interesting. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Richard Grant. Richard is a journalist with Smithsonian Magazine, and his latest piece is on the Great Dismal Swamp and the discovery of a community, a long-lasting community of escaped slaves, otherwise known as Maroons, in the Great Dismal Swamp, which is on the border of Virginia and North Carolina. You quote Sayers as saying that the people in the Dismal Swamp performed a critique of capitalism and rejected it completely. And he was referring to their lifestyle. And I was curious about that because he found just a small amount of actually things that you would look at as sort of these are samples of things that prove what's going on. But he was able to draw a certain amount of conclusions and some pretty right-on conclusions and straight-out conclusions. What is it that actually led to this? It has something to do with the significance of the discovery as well.
His reasoning, Dan Sayers' reasoning, is that if you made the decision that slavery was an impossible situation for you, you had kind of limited options. A lot of slaves committed suicide. A lot of slaves killed their children because they couldn't stand the thought of their children growing up in slavery. Now, what happened with these Maroons in the Great Dismal Swamp is that they chose to flee slavery and that they managed to form an alternative way of living that was outside the slave system. It was really outside the United States, although it was in the geography of the United States. We know from one of the Maroons that came out of there that all labor was communal in the middle of the swamp, which it would have been in an African context, that everyone was equal inside the swamp, that there was no hierarchy. Leaders didn't have the power of coercion, just of persuasion. And Sayers takes all this as evidence that these people rejected capitalistic enslavement for an entirely new way of living. But I should point out that Sayers is a Marxist, so that probably has colored his viewpoint somewhat. He's kind of an odd character. He's a Marxist and a vegan who smokes about two packs a day and drinks these monster energy drinks all day and then likes to relax with several beers in the evening.
Okay.
He's kind of like the world's unlikeliest vegan.
But probably, yeah. No, actually, I should let you know you're also talking to another communist on the phone right now.
Yeah. What do you think of his analysis here?
Look, I don't have enough evidence or anything to speak on it myself. Do I think it's possible that they actually decided that they would try to form some other form of society that had different relations in there? Yeah, I think that is possible. If you're living under slavery and the brutality of slavery and what you've seen, and then you also have the influence of people who are more recently or have memories of people who are more recently from Africa and brought into slavery and they're with you, or they may have talked to you on the plantations or whatnot, there's a lot to say in favor of the idea that they rejected capitalism, whether they called it capitalism or not. They rejected the...
Yeah, well, they clearly didn't call it
right,
capitalism,
yeah, I know,
but they knew the brutality of the system that they lived under.
Right. That system actually did reduce them to beasts of burden, and it was solely for the enrichment of the plantation owner. But there's been a lot of studies coming out now lately about the importance of the profits made in the slave system to the development of industry in the U.S. It's very significant in terms of drawing that, but it also brings up another question here, which is, you talked about him reading history in the ground. What I read also is that he only had like a shoebox full of material when all was said and done that he brought out. And when he looks at it, it was very small stuff. And there was a whole way, an approach he had to make that could not be just sort of, well, I want it to be this way, so I'll just say it's this way. But he had to examine all this stuff. And let's talk about a little bit about his method and what you thought of that.
I guess the reason why he's taken seriously is because all of his archaeological work and the conclusions that he's drawn have been well received by the vast majority of his peers in the field. I mean, he's an extremely skillful and serious archaeologist. Now, if you're living in the middle of the Great Dismal Swamp for 200 years, most of what you're going to use as tools, most of your material culture is going to be organic and biodegradable. It's going to leave no trace. His most exciting find was the soil footprints of the cabin posts. that proved that there was large cabins, even the outline of these cabins kind of preserved in the soil with porches and storage rooms. And these were not shacks. These were kind of frontier-style log cabins. That was a major discovery, because who the hell else would want to build a cabin in the middle of this horrible swampy morass? The kind of basic common sense logic there. The other interesting thing there is that the only source of stone in the middle of the swamp was tools left behind by Native Americans. What is characteristic of these communities is that they will take, say, an arrowhead that they find, and they will turn it into another kind of tool, like a little scraping knife. You find that reusing of Native American stone tools and the repurposing. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of one of the archaeological signatures of these maroon swamp communities.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that also struck me is when he was talking about, and you had just mentioned this earlier, this point about the method that he uses. And I was really struck by the method that he used in understanding that the Great Dismal Swamp was not just a straight up level swamp that had a lot of mud holes in it, even though there were many of them. He had to make a leap based on what he knew, what he had seen, what he had assessed, what he had evaluated, and actually make a leap in his thinking to the idea that there might actually be higher ground. There might actually be solid spaces there. And that was kind of an interesting leap for him to make in this. And it's what made possible this whole discovery, right?
Yeah, it was this island that he got led to. That's when it all started. That was the major discovery. Hunters had used this island in recent years, but it was completely unknown to any historians or archaeologists. And now Sayers has discovered that there are 200 inhabitable islands in the Great Dismal Swamp. He's excavated 1% of one island and found evidence of perhaps thousands of people living there. So one of the big questions is how many escaped slaves or maroons are living in here. The archaeology has only just begun. There's a lot to eat in there. There was feral hogs, there's fish, some evidence they were growing rice and corn and little field plots. And a lot of biomass to feed people in there.
Yeah, yeah. And so these communities, in a different way than anything that we might have suspected before, these communities did actually live for quite some time, and on what they were able to discover in the swamp. Because you're looking at all these things where you think about the Underground Railroad, even you look at the Free State of Jones.
Free State of Jones, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I kept thinking of that in relation to what Sayers has discovered and what he's studying and how this is developing, because they weren't so removed that they weren't known, but they had a certain amount of cover living in that area. But they did not manage to build the kind of ongoing social structures that these escaped slaves managed to build. And that was something that really struck me.
I mean, the fact that they were in there for 10 generations, probably with recent arrivals, there was a core community in the middle of this swamp that was there for 10 generations. I would dearly love to unearth some kind of oral history from the people that came out. You know, everyone came out during the Civil War.
Wow.
He doesn't find any more artifacts after the Civil War. One of the big questions is, where do those people go? And that's another project waiting to be done, is a kind of oral history in the surrounding communities. Does anyone have family stories about great-great-grandfathers coming out of the swamp?
Yeah, that's exactly the next question I was going to ask you, and we can still pursue that a little bit. But the fact that they discovered these communities of maroons in the swamp actually opened a door for a lot of other archaeologists and for even a whole different approach to actually discovering this stuff, to actually investigating this stuff. And how many other towns or settlements have been found in the wake of the discovery of this one?
This field is really starting to open up now. We've got archaeologists working in the remains of maroon communities in Florida, in South Carolina, in the swamps outside New Orleans. The Great Dismal Swamp was definitely the largest, and it was also the only one that seems to have been completely removed from the outside world. And these other maroon communities, you know, people would run off and escape and form an autonomous community, but they would still be going back and forth to the plantation or wherever else. You find a lot more manufactured items in their camps, in their communities. These Great Dismal Swamp maroons, the interior maroons, are the only ones that kind of divorced themselves completely from the whole system.
Hmm. Amazing. Well, Richard, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Is there anything you'd like to put on as a cap to this?
American history is just, I feel it's still such a sort of unmined territory in a way that it keeps throwing up these unpredictable discoveries. And especially around the slavery system, I just feel like there's a lot that we still don't understand, a lot that we're just beginning to learn about here.
That's exactly what I was thinking as well. And including, you know, we've seen a spate of books, not nearly enough, but we've seen a spate of books that actually begin to tell a different history than the one that in this country, anyway, people grew up learning about the history of slavery and all this other stuff. And you begin to see not only how widespread it was, but how devastating it was to the people that were enslaved. And the fact that now that it's over, people, they're not held in actual slavery, but the particular conditions that exist that Black people in this country are facing are rooted actually back in those days. And seeing these communities and finding these new historical exposures is critical to understanding the situation today and what needs to be done to change all that.
Well, keep your eye on Smithsonian in the next few months, because I've got another story coming out that is related to this.
All right. We will definitely keep our eyes on the Smithsonian.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, Richard.
All right. Best of luck.
We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Sansara Taylor talking about the controversy around the birth of a nation. So stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Slave Song from David Murray. You know, I just saw the film Birth of a Nation when it opened up last weekend, and I have to say it was even more powerful than I thought it would be. And I went to see it in the midst of a storm of controversy, in the midst of a lot of people saying that the film, before it even opened, was doomed to be a failure because of the controversy around it. And I wanted to revisit that controversy and really argue for people to go and see this film. It's an extremely important film in the world today. And when you listen to what Sansara has to say about the controversy around it, I think you too will feel that you've got to see this film and judge for yourself about the power and importance of it. So let's take a listen to the conversation we had with Sansara Taylor about 3 weeks ago. I'm very pleased to be bringing back to the show Sansara Taylor. And Sansara is joining us to talk about a subject that has been very, very sharply posed for everybody, unless you're buried under a rock. But even then, it's probably even sharply posed for people objectively. It's the attack that's come down on Nate Parker. He's the director and writer, co-writer of the film Birth of a Nation. And there's been a massive assault that's been unleashed against Nate, connected up with a rape charge that he was accused of rape back, 20 years ago or 17 years ago or something. And he was found innocent on that. And yet this has come up now. And it's very, very interesting, to say the least, that it's come up at exactly the time that this killer film, Birth of a Nation, an amazingly powerful film that has the potential of really dramatically drawing some very sharp lines and polarizing things in a way that they need to be polarized in a certain sense. And joining us to talk about this, as I said, is Sansara Taylor. She's a writer for Revolution Newspaper and RevCom.us, and she is the initiator of Stop Pornography and Patriarchy, the Enslavement and Degradation of Women. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael, it's good to be with you.
Yeah, good to have you here. We're going to jump in because I don't want to spend any time talking. I want you to talk. But you wrote an article that I was blown away by. I thought it was so important. It was around this controversy around Nate Parker and Birth of a Nation. And the title of the article is The Birth of a Nation Can Contribute to Liberation. Re-prosecuting Nate Parker does not. What were you getting at there?
Well, just to fill everybody in case you haven't heard about this, The Birth of a Nation is a new film that was written, it's directed, and it stars Nate Parker. And it's about the rebellion of Nat Turner, the slave rebellion. It's one of the most heroic and righteous uprisings in American history. And it is not just a story of the horrors that were inflicted on Black people during slavery, which would be important to tell, or even nonviolent resistance. This is a bloody revolt, and it was a righteous revolt. And this is the kind of thing that everybody needs to look at. Everybody needs to confront. It gets to the nature and the essence of what America has been founded on and continues to carry out: the oppression of Black people, the terror. Today it's by police. It used to be by the Klan. Before that it was the slave overseer and the slave catchers. The forms have changed, but it's continued. And it's a big deal that such a film has been made. It broke the records for the highest selling independent film ever out of Sundance Film Festival. It got rave reviews everywhere it's been reviewed, and it was billed to be a major release in Hollywood across the country. And right on the eve of this being released, Variety Magazine, New York Times, a number of major publications, gatekeeper publications, publications that represent different sections of the rulers in this country, decided to dredge up and splash all over the front pages that 17 years ago, Nate Parker was accused of raping a woman. And that's a huge, that's a serious charge. Rape is a horrific crime, not only to the women who are victims of it, where it shatters their lives. It's, I mean, you never recover from being raped. It's a horrific crime. But it's also a weapon that's used to terrorize all women, whether they're victims of it or not. It's a form of enforcing patriarchy and the oppression of women in this country and around the world. It's not a light charge. It's not something to dismiss, but it is highly suspect. I'll put it this way, that he was tried. He was found not guilty of this accusation. 17 years later, no new evidence has come out. Nothing has changed, except he's about to release this film that is very, could be very powerful and touches right to the core of what a lot of the rulers in this country and powerful forces in this country do not want people to look at. So right when this film, Birth of a Nation, is about to be released, this controversy is dredged back up. It wasn't a controversy. It was the manufactured controversy. And a lot of people took the bait. I have to say, I was very disappointed and upset that a lot of people, including a lot of prominent Black voices, feminist voices, came out and said, look, you know what? I'm not going to go see this film because of this. And I think it's very wrong, it's very damaging, and it goes against the interests of the people. And I hope we can sort that out some. And because my point is not to dismiss or belittle the problem of patriarchy and rape, but to actually sort out what was true and who and what is served by turning this into a controversy now, casting a huge cloud over this film. And frankly, I think that it works against the liberation of women. It works against the liberation of Black people. It works against a method of understanding what's true and creating a culture where art and radical ideas can flourish for people to take the bait and turn their backs on this film because of this controversy.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was thinking about this as you were talking and thinking about it in reading your article a couple of times and just having talked to a lot of people who've seen the film and people who know about it and have looked into it. This point that you're making right now about this being a manufactured controversy is extremely important. At the same time, what you've been talking about is about the impact of rape and the horror that rape is and how it's so endemic to this society, to this kind of society. I mean, all over the world, this is one of the major questions facing humanity is the horror of rape and abuse facing women. At the same time, the point that you make in the article is extremely important, that the importance of not guilty, those two words, that in a court, not guilty, and scientifically determining the truth as opposed to having a trial by tyranny. And one of the things you quote in your piece, you quote Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, saying, "For humanity to advance beyond a state in which might makes right and where things ultimately come down to raw power relations will require as a fundamental element in this advance an approach to understanding things, an epistemology which recognizes that reality and truth are objective and do not vary in accordance with nor depend on different narratives and how much authority an idea or narrative may have behind it or how much power and force can be wielded on behalf of any particular idea or narrative at any given point." This is an extremely important point in relation to all this. So let's talk about that a little.
It's a big idea. There's a lot packed into it. But I'll say this is that if we want to get free, the world is a complicated place. We have to go for what's true. We have to understand the evidence. We have to look and follow the facts and the evidence wherever they lead us. And we can't respond. You know, one of the big arguments that's been made around this case and this controversy is, look, women who have been raped are so often shamed and blamed and disbelieved when they come forward. And so often men who rape women get away with it. So we have an obligation to believe the victim. She must be telling the truth. And in this case, the woman who made the accusation later committed suicide. And it's a great tragedy. So she's not in the picture anymore to tell her story at all. But I think that the logic of that is very damaging. The fact that men often get away with rape, the fact that women are overwhelmingly shamed and blamed and disbelieved, that has to be fought. But that has to be fought on the basis of marshaling the evidence that shows, no, rape happens all the time. No, it's excused, it's belittled, and it's woven into the culture and the fabric and the legal system and the economy and the religious codes and the traditions of thousands of years, and we need to make a revolution to uproot all of that. But that can be shown with evidence. To respond to that with a knee-jerk that, well, rather than choosing to dismiss the victims all the time, let's choose to believe the victims all the time. To do that as a response, you may think you're siding with the underdog, but actually you're throwing away the measure of what makes something true, which is the evidence. This is where we come back to that quote you just read from Avakian. He makes the point, if we want to get to a world where the truth is not determined by might makes right, you know, I say there's weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and I have an army to back it up, so there, we'll print it on the front page. We'll call everybody who disputes it a lunatic and a conspiracy theorist, and then we'll bomb a country and destroy a whole people. That's might makes right. The facts be damned. If we want to get to a world beyond that, we have to fight for an epistemology and an approach to understanding what's true that's based on evidence and scientifically grounded evidence, digging into what's actually true, what corresponds to objective reality, and not saying, let's choose our own narrative in opposition to that. And if that's the best you do, you're never going to get beyond a world where might makes right. And so there's a lot of implications for that in how we fight today and how we sort out something that's highly complex, like the fact that women are often disbelieved and the fact that accusations of sexual assault and rape against Black men have been a license to kill. I mean, we talk about the Scottsboro Boys, we talk about Emmett Till, we could talk about the Central Park Five and many, many other cases. How do you sort that out and not just pick between which narrative that you think might be useful and serve your immediate interest, but how do you sort it through? You have to go for the evidence. And in this case, I did read a huge portion of the transcript of the trial. I read a lot of the evidence that was admitted. I read a lot of the evidence that was illegally obtained by police breaking the law and illegally recording Nate Parker years ago. And I read all this, and I don't know if he was guilty or not. I'm not making that claim. I do know that he engaged in sexual conduct with this woman that was at minimum very degrading, very dehumanizing, and is part of a culture of patriarchy, and we should fight that, and we should challenge that, and that should be changed. But I also know that in reading this, every single argument that I have read that says, well, Nate Parker must be guilty, it's not substantiated by the facts of this case. It's just not. And so that matters. And it matters to what kind of culture we want to have. And it matters to whether individuals can change. This was 17 years ago. He was engaged in things that were very degrading to women. But this was 17 years ago. And people have to be allowed to change and transform and to scapegoat a 19-year-old for the culture that this country propagates and to demonize him rather than going at the whole system. And yes, holding him accountable, but all men and all people who participate in this, but then not letting that be used, not letting people's legitimate concern and righteous fury about rape be used to bury a film, which actually should be evaluated on its merits, not on the basis of the artist anyhow, even if he had been guilty. There's a lot of layers to this. How do we see art? How do we see an atmosphere where people are allowed to change and transform? And how do we not let different sections of the oppressed be pit against each other?
See, that's something I was really interested in. And you hit at that a couple times in your piece. There's people saying, well, look, if you're taking the stand that you're taking, somehow you're not taking seriously the oppression of women. And you're doing that because opportunistically you think he's made an important film that should be out there and you're willing to turn your head to whatever else he may have done. And I think that it's really important for people to be clear on what's being said there and what's the truth in terms of what's happening here. And again, you know, I've read a lot of editorials, a lot of opinion pieces where people come up and they constantly start with this wink, wink. Yes, he was found not guilty, but we know he actually did some dastardly stuff. You hit again in your article too, and it's related to the first thing I said, is that people can change and the system can't. And there's a big important difference between those two things. And I'd like to talk about that for a minute.
To begin with, I want to go back to the first point you made about if you support this film, you're not taking rape seriously. That's not true. This film should be evaluated on its own merits. It should be seen as a piece of art, and it has a great contribution to make. But I would like to compare that argument to those who said, look, if you don't support the U.S. imperialist invasion of Iraq, Afghanistan, and then Iraq, then you don't support the fight against the oppression of women there, because that was one of the excuses that was being used. Oh, we have to go in there to liberate women. Well, you can have genuine concern about the oppression of women, and you should, around the world, including in those places, and you should fight that. But that does not mean that you should allow your concern to be used as a cover to carry out war crimes. Now, I know it's a different situation, but the analogy holds. Legitimate concern and fury against rape needs to actually grow and needs to be an even bigger fight that gets waged among many more people. But we should not allow ourselves to be used and that concern to be used as a cover by ruling class interests and reactionary interests to bury a film that needs to be seen, to carry out something that actually goes against the interests of the people. And I will say it's not every day the New York Times runs a front page story 3 days in a row about a independent film, you know, and a 17-year-old allegation. And whatever the intents of those who wrote the article, I'm not doubting the sincerity of the feminist voices and the black voices who spoke out against this, but their voices don't always get elevated in this way. They don't always get elevated in this way. They're being used right now, and they're allowing themselves to be used. It's harmful, and it's not backed up by the facts, and that matters. I know we're going to run out of time, so you asked the other question. One of the things that was leveled against Nate Parker, people said he's hypocritical for insisting that America look at its past of slavery and then saying that he doesn't want to be put under a microscope every time he comes into the public eye and have this 17-year-old case dissected each time. And I'll say this, I don't think there's an analogy there. I don't think there's hypocrisy there. And I don't speak for Nate Parker, and he actually has come out and explored this past, and he seems to be learning and transforming and acknowledging that he never thought as deeply about rape and rape culture, and he's being forced to now, and that's a positive thing. So I'm not speaking for him. Nate Parker, like others, we live in a dog-eat-dog, patriarchal, white supremacist society. And it breeds that in people. And people don't treat each other well. They're trained by this system to not treat each other well. And we have to fight for people to change as part of the fight to change the world and to make an actual revolution. But we also have to allow people the space to change. You think about the millions of people in prison, many of whom were caught up in things that shouldn't be criminal, nonviolent offenses, drugs, this kind of thing. But many of whom have done really harmful things. They have to be allowed to change and transform as part of changing the world. You can't hold people to the worst they've ever done in their lives and put them in a box and lock them there for life. And people can change, and that's very important. In contrast, this system, the system of American capitalism and imperialism today, it was founded on slavery. It was built up on white supremacy, theft of land from Mexico, genocide against Native people, invasions, coups, occupations, torture, exploitation, and plunder all over the world. This is its nature. It's a system. It's not a person. It's a system that has laws and dynamics and the way it operates. And if you deeply study that, and that's something Bob Avakian has done deeply, including in the new book coming out, The New Communism, which is on revcom.us, something that I've been studying. It's something that other people need to get into. The more you study that, the more you understand these are not incidental. They're not secondary traits. This is the core essence of America, and it cannot be reformed, and everybody has to confront that. Slavery was not some secondary thing that America improved and got beyond. The forms have changed, but the police are out killing black people every day. Alton Sterling, Philando Castile, Oscar Grant, Sean Bell, Ayanna Stanley Jones. You go every day, you open the newspaper today, tomorrow, you'll find another body in the street. It's a different form, but this is integral to America. And so we have to confront that, and we should never forgive that. We should never forget that. We should never excuse that. We actually have to confront that, and we have to make a revolution to get rid of that. And so in that context, I think a film like this can contribute a great deal to shining a light, not only on the horrors of what this country has done, but on the righteousness of people rising up, including in a bloody rebellion like Nat Turner's. People need to look at that. And they need to go out of their comfort zone. And so this has a contribution to make re-prosecuting Nate Parker, especially with a culture of media tyranny, trial by Twitter, a whole atmosphere which has been whipped up, which works against the oppressed. It works against seeking the truth, which is going to work against the oppressed. It's always going to feed those who have might, because they're going to be able to churn out their opinions in a much bigger way. But what we saw with Nate Parker, people all over Twitter, people all over social media, people in all these blogs and front page articles saying, well, we know he was guilty. I was raped. I am entitled to decide that he was guilty. We have all these people saying, well, there was a witness. I mean, I saw this over and over again, who testified, who said that he was invited into this sexual encounter and he declined. It was a drunken late night. What's in dispute is the woman says she did not consent. She was too drunk. And Nate Parker said she was fully participatory and she consented. And that's in dispute. And it's a real dispute. And that goes on all the time. And it's not a good situation. But he says he was invited to take part in it and he declined. He said it didn't seem right to me. So everybody took this quote and they said, see, that shows he's guilty. No, that doesn't show he's guilty. That shows that somebody thought it was morally objectionable. That doesn't show that it was rape. But all these people, they pick it up. They didn't read this testimony. They didn't read the courts. They just repeat things over and over and over again. And then they create a culture where any denial on the part of Nate Parker, any denial on his part, any silence on his part, any attempt to defend himself and say, actually, the record shows I was acquitted. All this is used as further fuel to indict him, further fuel to say he's evading. It's a mentality that once you're accused, everything you do just feeds the mob, honestly. The mob that has nothing to do with and no measure and no standard of discovering what's true. And people allow themselves to be led along like this. And it's very destructive. It's destructive in this case, and it has horrendous implications for the kind of culture that we should have, for the kind of search for the truth and the standards of truth that we should have. The world is complicated, and you cannot get free by allowing yourself to be led along by a rumor mill, even if it's in the name of stopping something like rape. You cannot allow yourself to be led along like that or go along with that. That has to be called out. It's very damaging, and not just for this film and not just for the individual who is Nate Parker, who does matter.
And on
but
that,
for much, much bigger, much, much bigger implications about how do we sort things out and how do we get free.
Exactly. So, as you said, this film cannot be allowed to be buried under all this, bull. Sansara, thank you very much for joining us today.
All right. Thanks, Michael. Take care.
All right. We've just been talking with Sansara Taylor from End Pornography and Patriarchy, The Enslavement and Degradation of Women. And we've been talking about the controversy surrounding Nate Parker's new film, Birth of a Nation. Go see it, no matter what. Go see that film. All right, this brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of our guests today, Sansara Taylor, Richard Grant from Smithsonian Magazine, and Elisa Hartz, the attorney with Public Counsel. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my board op for today, Teddy Robinson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And a recommendation, a quick recommendation before we go out, go to revcom.us and check out what's going on with Bob Avakian's new book, The New Communism. You don't want to miss this book, folks. Pick it up, read it, argue about it. Let me know what you think of it, all right? We're going to go out now with Numbered Days from Ross Michael. Talk to you again next week.
Thank you.